We're going to move on to my chat with a fantastic person, Nancy McLean. She's written this fantastic book called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. And let's proceed, because it's a cracker.
Thank you very much for talking to me. I was absolutely engrossed by your book.
Thank you.
Much congratulations for the depth of work. I mean, you've gone out of your way to make a book that's easily accessible to the general public, but it's quite clear that the level of research is mammoth.
Thank you. You see my battle scars.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, what's important is that what's going on in countries like the US, as we are seeing right at the moment with the attacks on voting rights,
right,
are also being experienced in places like Australia. So
yes,
we're talking about what is actually fundamentally attacks on democracy, but they're not a scattergun effect, are they? Your research has shown that actually this has been a deliberate step-by-step approach to undermining democracy and majority rule. And you've found a particular character, James McGill Buchanan, rather who precedes the Chicago School of Economics neoliberal approach.
Coterminous with it, and he actually got his degree at Chicago, but considered himself very different from the later Chicago figures like Friedman.
Yeah, okay. So it's quite clear that it's got a south-north complexion in the US context. So can you explain to my listeners where that comes from? Because it's important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I did not set out to find the story that I told. I was actually pursuing a different story. So if your listeners have never heard of James McGill Buchanan, they should not worry about that, because not many people have outside of the academic disciplines. He worked in economics and political science and to some degree constitutional law, and also the conservative, or I should say the libertarian / conservative think tank and operational milieu. He was somebody who kind of deliberately seemed to like to operate more in the shadows than in the public. He didn't have Milton Friedman's gifts of glibness or, you know, comfort in the limelight. You know, he wasn't he was a clear writer, but you'd never say he was a great writer. It was not a kind of mediagenic personality, but he had a very significant impact, particularly on the way that many thought about democracy and on what's happening to democracy now. So the reason there's a significant South-North connection to this is that he spent most of his life working in Virginia, his scholarly life working in Virginia. He was actually born in Tennessee to a farm family in Tennessee in the during the Depression. But he became engaged with politics after he moved to the University of Virginia in Charlottesville in 1956, and that was at the peak of what was called massive resistance to the Brown versus Board of Education decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, which mandated the end of legally sponsored segregation in schools. And he was part of a then small group of people, economists and such, on the neoliberal right who opposed that decision, as they opposed the New Deal that they believed it came out of, and the CIO and the whole kind of transformation of the federal government to be more responsive to the people over the course of the 20th century. So he ended up in kind of alliance with the segregationist forces in Virginia that were trying to shift public monies from public schools to private schools that would be beyond the reach of the court. And that's how I first got on his trail. And then I continued to pursue it, and it led in directions that I'm sure we'll talk about.
Yeah, exactly. So that early sort of anti-desegregation of schools is really important, because it's an ideological framework that is embedded in the entire focus of what turns out to be as it grows, basically an approach that undermines the concept of majority rule and the acceptance of an oligarchy, that freedom equals a very small group of people having control over the all public assets, and that inequality is not a problem.
Yeah, and it took me a while to wrap my mind around this way of thinking about the world because it was so antithetical to the way that I think about it. And you know, I work on the history of social movements. I've looked at labor, civil rights, and women's movement. Movements that do not think in the way that these folks think. And so one of the elements that I had to wrap my mind around was a defense of minority rights in this tradition. But the minority, I realized, the minority is that he was Buchanan and his colleagues were concerned about were never the ones that I would think of, you know, like LGBT people or African Americans in the South or, you know, Mexican Americans or Jewish or, you know, other groups. Or political dissenters. They were really, when they would talk about the oppression of the minority by the majority, they were talking about the very wealthy and about corporations who felt, you know, whose leaders felt oppressed by regulation or by taxation, the levels of taxation that prevailed at mid-century. So it was a very distinctive tradition, but that ended up, you know, essentially, creating the conditions for oligarchy to reign and doing that, you know, advocating those kinds of policies that would enable that not only in the US but transnationally. So it's kind of no wonder that you're seeing some of this in Australia and that others are seeing the impacts elsewhere because this was really a transnational school of thought that is now being acted on by a transnational network of think tanks, many of which are, you know, have affiliates in Australia and other places, such as the Institute for Public Affairs. In Australia, that I'm sure you've dealt with.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the interesting thing about this, of course, is that it's not, as I said, a scattergun effect. It's step by step. And so
Yes.
Buchanan is an academic, and he, if you look at he, as you do, he produces particular tomes that tap the ball into particular directions, doesn't he? Very important. To underpinning using academia to underpin a concept of scientific economy.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And that was another thing that was really fascinating is to see the difference between the public presentation of Buchanan and of his various centers at these ironically public universities in Virginia. He was at three different ones over the years. And as you say, it was very much a presentation that we are the scientists, we are engaged in realism, the other people are the romantics, et cetera. But in the private papers that I was able to go through, I saw him very much appealing to corporate donors, saying, you know, we have the best, kind of the best case out there because other people are just making the case for markets, which is not always persuasive to people, but we're making the case that you shouldn't trust government and that government can't be relied upon, et cetera. And we think that's ultimately kind of the trumping case. And also the letters that they would write, that he and others would write, their letters of recommendation were always had some ideological element. Which is really quite shocking because it's not, you know, it's not the normal practice in higher education. So these enterprises were very, very much political from the outset. And so they really also give us a window into something that people often today refer to as the corporate university. And you could see this in his centers beginning in the second half of the 1950s forward. They were always supported by private. Pretty arch right wing corporate money of the kind that, in fact, the same funder supported Buchanan's first 5 years in Virginia, that supported the Mont Pelerin Society, getting Americans to go to the meetings of this, you know, original kind of neoliberal thought collective, some people have said, you know, whose meetings were always in Europe in the early years, and also paid for the salaries of figures like Friedrich Hayek at Chicago and Ludwig von Mises in New York. So deeply, deeply ideological funders who wanted kind of particular research programs and outcomes, and in fact got them.
Yeah, well, the Montpirolin, Switzerland, and in fact, they're called the Austrian thinkers, aren't they?
Yeah, they spoke of Austrian economics, which is very interesting. There's another good book on that subject, saying that that was really, in a lot of ways, the framing of Austrian economics was something Charles Koch and his funding kind of did, because in the real world of Austrian economics, they were varied traditions and different kinds of economists, but they stamped particular figures, you know, above all the best known being Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises, as Austrian economics, and kind of created a brand product, if you will, that was exceedingly hostile to government action on, you know, in response to the will of the people, which they referred to as collectivism and saw as a real problem emerging over the 20th century.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, isn't it, that at a certain point, Buchanan actually articulates the notion that they've got specific aims, which is to basically allow very rich people to have and corporations to have complete freedom, carte blanche, no regulation. That government's only function is to deal with the military and defence and public order. That's the only function that it has. But he was finding it difficult, they were finding it difficult to get their politicians into particular governments. And so he pinpoints the notion that you can't trust politicians because they're only self-interested. Now, this is a particularly, this isn't just a notion, this is actually a plank of their thoughts, isn't it? That individuals are just completely out for themselves.
Yeah, so that was just, you know, a kind of core element of what they called public choice economics, was to apply, you know, the notion of economic man to political actors and say they were only interested in their self, you know, in self-interest, not in the public good, as they said. Now, one irony of that is that they saw that elected officials wanted to get reelected. So one thing they would do is popular things that these folks didn't approve of.
Which
So
is
that's
actually a fantastic element of democracy. It is the power
exactly.
lever of democracy.
Right. You know, but if you wanted to be popular, you know, you would do things like, you know, providing Social Security, right? Providing retirement security, you know, acting on climate change, you know, restraining fossil fuel extraction, providing, you know, a good education for people at all, you know, age levels, et cetera. So there's all these things that are popular, but they cost money and they lead to taxation and to tax transfers, which these folks saw as illegitimate. Again, going back to that notion of minority rights. And it's probably also important to understand that they ideologically just refused to see coercion in the economy. They only saw coercion in government. You know, so government could make you do things like pay taxes, but they would say, you know, as 19th century, you know, classical liberals did, well, you know, if I offer you a job for 36 cents an hour and there's no other jobs around, and you can take my job or leave it. But they don't see coercion in something like that, right? In offering terms of employment that are would make it impossible to sustain human life. Like that's because you have the right to refuse that contract. So again, you know, I think understanding the a priori assumptions that are in play here is helpful.
Yeah, and so this puts into perspective the how it's quite clear that privatization, no taxes for corporation, the subversion of law and the Supreme Court to their perspective, the no public schools, using public money for private schools but have no control over their curriculum. which is an oxymoron, actually. If you pay for something in their world, then you should have control. The attacks on public universities and the attacks on social security systems become quite clear why this is happening, why this should be so, because this is what this small group of oligarchs actually believe is freedom.
Yeah, but I think it's also important that is all true, but I think it's also important to realize that these are smart actors, and some of what they're saying, for you and I, it's hair-raising, right? And I'm sure for many of your listeners who are thinking, well, people who have ideas like that can't possibly get elected on those ideas, so we're safe from that. So I think it's also important for people to understand the stealth element of all this, and that's, part of the subtitle of my book. And that piece is crucial because the smartest of these actors, people like James Buchanan or Charles Koch, who becomes a key funder, the key funder of all of this. Very smart individuals. And it didn't take long for them to realize that people were never going to vote for the values that they stood for or the agenda that they wanted to see implemented. And, that became clear to different people in different times and ways, but certainly for Buchanan, it became clear with Social Security privatization in the 1980s when they tried to do that. And instead of, he actually has language that says, that Social Security was popular, among men and women, old and young, black, brown, and white, north and south, east and west. You just went through all the differences. And instead of saying, well, golly, then it must be a pretty great program, and we should make sure we do everything we can to, to keep it and let it thrive. No, he said, so if you want to get rid of it, which they did, they wanted to, go to private accounts, individual accounts, you would have to do, you'd have to, he doesn't say stealth, but I call it crab walking. So he gave a multi-step program to say, well, first you have to say it's not solvent, right? So to make people, who are paying in but not yet receiving benefits feel like, well, God, it's not going to be there for me. Why should I pay into it, right? Then he also suggested that you pay off the existing claimants. So the older people who would be the most focused on the health of the program, you get them out of the fight, right?
Yeah,
You
you
make sure.
grandfather it. They, what
Yeah.
we call it
So you,
grandfathering it. Yeah.
yeah. And then he also talked about basically finding strategies to split up the coalition that was in support of this program, including by turning young people against Social Security recipients, which is so interesting. And I think that's important too. So this is in no way conservative in the way that most of us would think about it, like to make grandma and grandpa sound like parasites, which is exactly what he did in the language that he used of parasites for these public programs. That is really radical right stuff, right? It's not,
Well, it's
most.
right center stage in Australia at the moment.
Yes.
Framed as rights concern to reform the program to protect it, because without doing it, it will be bankrupt.
And so there's a lot of disinformation that's involved in this political project, on multiple issues. So Social Security, of course, they also worked with the tobacco companies in the 1980s and 90s when they were facing attacks for the public health impacts of tobacco, and they did a lot of work on contract to help their public image and to support them in Congress and in the states. And then similarly, they moved on to the fossil fuel industry and defending fossil fuels and Koch Industries, which is, Charles Koch's, he's one of the richest men in the world and has one of the largest privately held companies in the world, and its core base was in fossil fuels. So for them, democracy was actually kind of an existential threat to their profit source.
Australia is a crime scene. It's unfinished business, this crime. People don't understand that it was a military exercise. It was military in the first place. It was Captain James Cook. It was Captain Arthur Phillip. Right through the history of Australia, it's a military exercise. Our people have suffered greatly because the white man is not prepared to act honourably and legally. It's still the case in this country today.
This is 3CR.
You're with Annie on Solidarity Breakfast, and we're listening to a chat I had with the wonderful Nancy McLean, who has written a book called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. It's available at Scribe. before we listen to the last part of that chat, it might be interesting to remind people that this group of people who formed the coalition to destroy democracy, and this particular focus on this man called James McGill Buchanan. James McGill Buchanan was a economic advisor to Pinochet in Chile. And this group of people still maintain that Pinochet's Chile is a poster child for their views and economic process. Just let that sink in. Anyway, this is the last part of my chat.
You call it a fifth column. You pontificate that this is actually, this movement is a fifth column, and that they have actually, with Coke, rivers of gold have been running since the 1970s, and they've been tilling their boat through the waters to this final result. They must have been quite amazed when Trump, who's a complete opportunist, ran away with their ball for a moment.
Yeah, they were, you know, there definitely was some surprise there, but they very quickly accommodated to that. You know, he did not have, you know, roots in the established, you know, Republican Party. He didn't have people around him. He didn't even expect to be elected, as we now know, you know, so he was sort of in a state of shock. But it was, they just did this kind of surround sound operation. And before you knew it, I forget what the exact figures are. It's been a minute, but something like 40 or more percent of his senior officials were from the Koch network, including key people like Vice President Mike Pence, his liaison to Congress, Mark Shore, you know, in the later days, Mark Meadows, who was his chief of staff, who had been the head of the Freedom Caucus in the U.S. House, Betsy DeVos, you know, you just go through the list. And so many of these people, Mike Pompeo, who was Secretary of State, they used to call him the congressman from Koch. He was from Kansas, where Koch Industries is based. So they very quickly became central to that administration and got through many things that they wanted, including the immediate pullout from the Paris Climate Accords. That was one of the first things that Trump did, and stopping any action on the climate, really decimating the Environmental Protection Agency. They pushed through a tax bonanza for corporations and wealthier earners. They decimated a lot of labor law. And of course, they got the three Supreme Court justices seated, who will carry an agenda that is extremely pro-corporate and to the right of 90% of the American people, including Republicans.
Actually, that's interesting. You should talk about the Republicans, because part of this whole process was the taking over of the Republican Party, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so Buchanan...
A similar thing happened here in the Liberal Party, where they got rid of all the smaller liberals.
And so that's interesting too. So in the US, the phrase that they would use is rhinos, Republicans in name only. And basically, it was like an occupying army of people who weren't from the Republican Party. You know, the core of these guys were hardcore libertarians. But they, you know, pushed this agenda that said, you're a Republican in name only if you raise taxes, act on the climate, compromise with Democrats in any way. And so what they did is drive moderates from the party. And they did it in a very, you know, again, a very shrewd way. They activated the party base, the people that are now, you know, the MAGA faction of the Republican Party. They had been the Tea Party people. But they, so they fed a lot of red meat to the base, you know, through media like Fox News and such. But then the donors were the key element too. The donors would put in big money for a primary challenge to any Republican who didn't toe the line. And they actually boasted about that at donor events. And I quote one of the key people in the book who spoke of this as the accountability play, our secret sauce, so to speak, meaning that pincer action between the donors and the base. And through that, they have transformed the Republican Party beyond recognition. I mean, there is more discipline in the Republican Party today in the U.S., in Congress, and in many state houses than the Bolshevik Party under Stalin. You know, I mean, they're terrified to fall out with the donors and with the base, and will leave office rather than face election if they don't, you know, if things have turned against them. So you see that now too. With I've been in Australia, I've been a couple times because there was a book publisher there, Scribe, that picked up the book, and I did some book tours, and I was so impressed by how much Australians knew about American politics and how closely they follow things. But I don't know if your listeners would know Liz Cheney, who's one of the only Republicans who stood up to Trump. And she's actually on this House Select Committee to investigate the insurrection of January 6th and Trump's attempted coup.
Where he should be in jail, actually.
Yes. But her home party in Wyoming has you know, publicly condemned her. She's facing a big primary challenge, so she's probably not going to be reelected. And the other person who serves on that, the only other Republican who serves on that committee, has already said he's not going to run again.
It brings to mind a thing that my daughter said to me, looking at the American scene. She expected there to be a civil war.
You know, there's more and more writing about that. There's a very good book that I just read. I think it's called How Civil Wars Start, but by a political scientist, very, very smart, thoughtful scholar who has studied civil wars, you know, on other continents, and, you know, has a and there are a number of things that they look for routinely. And those, you know, those alarms are being set in the U.S. So no, it is very frightening.
Yeah, very frightening. Part of their stealth approach, which is important to me, is being a person who was brought up Catholic and his father was a lawyer, double whammy structures, you know. Order, you know, order is the subversion of the legal system and the and the academic system and the not just the political system and the use of the media, but that thing about taking over the legal system and then misusing legislative process to get a particular result. This is also happening in Australia. It's particularly focused on unions, for example, that kind of stuff. Anyway, I'd like you to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's funny, when you started with being raised a Catholic, I thought you were going to go in a different direction, but there's really almost three boxes there that we could open up and go into. And one is that this enterprise would never be able to achieve anything through the political system had they not made strategic alliances with the religious right and the entrepreneurs of the American religious right.
And they're atheists, so they don't care. This is how callous and cynical they are.
Yeah, I mean that so many of the libertarians, yes, were vehemently, anti-church and anti-clerical, Buchanan included. But yeah, so they have been extremely savvy in tapping that huge base of voters, and those, evangelical, white evangelical voters are the core basis of the Republican Party now. They're the core basis of support for Trump. And one of the things that I realized too is that I don't know if they thought this at the outset. I mean, I've never seen, inside communications about this, or if it was just a fortuitous result. But, white evangelical Christians believe in creationism, right? They don't believe in evolution. And so you had people who were already primed to not believe science, to be suspicious of science, as a constituency. And that was cultivated, as I mentioned earlier, with the tobacco industry propaganda, in particularly in the 1980s and 90s, and then of course the fossil fuel stuff added to that. So that's so we have the religious box there, and through the media, we could jump to the media now. They have the believers and followers who watch Fox News are basically not watching a news service, but an identity creation, consolidation, and provocation enterprise. So there are really great media scholars and communication scholars who have really tracked this stuff, done really, really interesting scientific and statistical studies of how conservative media works. But basically, they've come to the conclusion that this is, especially with Fox, it's like a nonstop diet of the liberals hate you, they're ruining your institutions, they're taking your country, they spit on your faith, they blah, 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 they're going to ruin your kid, on and on and on and on. And then the counter is that you must fight them, right? You must be in fight or flight mode, so people don't even think clearly, if you get really steeped in this stuff. So the media piece is really crucial. And then you also touched on another important piece, which is schools and higher education. So this Koch network in the US, and again, it's not just them, like they work through so many different kind of front groups and specialty groups of different kinds. So there's literally hundreds. I mean, and they're constantly reinventing them and creating what one person who works against this network calls human shields, so you don't actually see the donors, and they have all the think tanks and things like that, but they've also done major investing in higher education. So there are over 300 campuses now in the US that are getting funding from the Charles Koch Foundation alone. There are centers at many universities where they have faculty and students, and the money just flows, to bring people into this, to put them into career pipelines. So they'll go from higher education into, say, the Heritage Foundation or the Federalist Society or the State Policy Network, or any of these other operations. And the campus bases also work closely with these other, parts of the apparatus to come up with ideas for policies that they can workshop, again, to supply the young talent that they didn't have in the old days, and to run defense for when they're criticized or exposed. So it is really a quite elaborate, integrated strategy that has been decades in the making. And, we're seeing the consequences of it all now.